thank you very much. And thank you for inviting me here. I think since this is the last session, I can say it's a very nice workshop and I really appreciate to be here. And thank you all that you attended the last session. Selection is the title. I'm a little bit cheating. Number theoretic problems here for me are more cryptographic problems. So I want to have a larger audience. And the focus is on open problems. And most of these problems are mainly personal problems. So the good thing is that they are not hard to solve, maybe. The bad thing is you might not become famous if you solve them, but you might have fun to solve them. Okay.
But you are happy.
Yeah, well, I'm happy if you solve that. That's fine. Okay, so let's see the overview of the talk. So, mainly I want to talk about solving polynomial equations. So that's very natural in crypto, and especially in public key cryptography. You have public key, you have secret keys. They are related by some equations, and you model the secret keys as the variables, so you get in a natural way polynomial equations. And you ask up to which extent you can solve these polynomial equations. And there are basically two approaches. So let's look at the RSA problem. You can ask how fast can you factor, and you can try to push down the running time of your factorization algorithm. Or you can try to relax the problem of factorization somehow, and can ask, well, if I relax this problem, when can I solve it still in polynomial time? So most of the approaches here, that most of these problems, these roots, computing the RSA secret key factoring and so on, are relaxed in such a way that we can solve these problems in polynomial time. And then we try to push the bounds somehow to the real problems. Okay? And the method behind this is Coppersmith's method, and it's a lattice-based method. It's polynomial time. You just have to apply the L-cube algorithm and that's it. And in some cases, it's provable, in some it's a heuristic, and I'll show you some of the problems for this. And it's not clear that given a polynomial equation, how to compute the optimal bounds. And that's one of the open problems. I will come to this open problem here. And if I have some time left, I will also make a comment or speculations about cyclic lattice and entropy. Okay, so since this is about lattices, I have to say a few words about lattices, what I mean with lattices. So here you have n vectors, they're in q to the n, so that you can compute with these vectors. They are linear independent, they span a lattice. So you look at the integer linear combinations of these lattices, of these vectors, sorry. And here's an example. So it's a parity lattice. You have the basis vectors 0, 2, and 1, 1. And this is the basis of this lattice here. And you already know you can go on to another lattice basis by unimodular transformation of the basis matrix. So here's another basis of the same lattice. But as I said, it's a unimodular transformation, so the basis matrix of the basis of the lattice stays the same. And this has also a geometric interpretation, namely the volume of this fundamental region of the lattice stays the same. The volume here is the same as here. And the volume is easy to compute, given the lattice basis. And you already have seen that it has a connection to the smallest vector in a lattice, namely what you would expect, that the smallest vector is the side length somehow of this fundamental region. So in dimension 2, the smallest vector should be not larger than the square root of the determinant, and in nth dimension should be not larger than the nth root of the determinant. Okay? And well, in dimension 2, we learned from Fong's talk that we can compute the shortest vector. This is a theorem of Lagrange. So given the basis of a two-dimensional lattice, you can compute in polynomial time the shortest vectors satisfying such a bound. So it's smaller than basically a square root of the determinant of L. So don't care about this 2. In Fong's talk, it was a 4 over 3, but we don't care about these constants at all. And in dimension n, it's a famous Lenstein-Dobach algorithm. So given a lattice spanned by this basis, V1 up to Vn, you can compute in polynomial time So that means polynomial in the dimension of the lattice, polynomial in the embedding degree, which is the same in our case, and polynomial in the logs of the entries of the basis matrix, another basis where the smallest vector of this basis is, well, roughly the nth root of the determinant. And in fact, you see here an approximation factor, which is 2 to the n, but for Coppersmith's method, it's not important whether you have a factor of 2 to the n here, because this will be the major part. So this will just go into a small error term epsilon. And it's not important whether you can solve a shorter spectral problem, you just have to have an approximation of a shorter spectrum, and that's it. So that's basically everything we need to know about lattices. So let's come to some applications first, and I will get you somehow interested into the subject. And later on, we will see how this Coppersmith method works. So just here, the applications first. First problem is the RSA problem. So you are given a modulus n. Let's always think of n being 1,000 bit and p and q being 500 bits. You're given an e in set for event star, and you're given a ciphertext, which is n raised to the power mod n. And well, you want to find the underlying plain text of the message. Now, you all know this problem is hard in working with the RSA function, but the question is, can we relax this problem such that we can get polynomial time algorithms? And, well, the first thing that comes to mind is we relax it in such a way that we restrict the parameters. So here you see we choose a small e, and this is actually very often done in practice, so most of the implementations of RSA use an e equal to 3, and we also use a small n. Well, this is also done in practice, because normally you just exchange a secret key by RSA, so your secret key might be about 128 bits or something like this, and this is 1,000 bits, so it's reasonably small. And you immediately see, if you now raise n to the e power, you can forget about the mod n, because the result is smaller than n, and well, you can get work just by taking cube roots. And actually, there was an attack this year presented crypto SRAM session by Bleichenbacher, which essentially uses this attack. I mean, it's simple to avoid it, you just have to pad your message, but be aware that the padding is done in the right way. Okay? So you might ask as the next generalization of this attack, what happens if em itself is not small, but you know, let's say, the most significant bits of m? So it's something like the inhomogeneous case of this. So the unknown part of m is still small, but you know a large fraction of m. So here, this is my notation, m is now a known part plus some unknown part. So think of a message, today's password is, and then the password, and that's the x. Okay? And you see here, the bound is the same. So let's take e is equal to 3, then we can recover the unknown part as long as it is 333 bits. That's a non-trivial result. So given 1,000-bit message, we need to know only two-thirds of the message, and we can recover the rest of the polynomial time. And well, the underlying polynomial is simple. You just have known part plus unknown part, and well, if you want to recover the least significant bits, you have to find a root of this polynomial modulo n. So the next question is, can you extend this bound slightly? So here you have the bound n to the 1 over e, here you have just plus epsilon, and it's very easy to see, yes, you can extend, just write x to the basis n to the 1 over e, and then your x is small enough, and well, you do a proof for search over k. But the first question is, can you do better? So for this proof for search, maybe is there a square root attack? We don't know. For now, it's just proof for search. It would be interesting to know, and now we'll come back to this problem. And the next relaxation is no longer polynomial time. So what happens if your n is small and splittable? And here you see a square root of attack of Bonnet, Zhu, and Nguyen. So you split your m in two parts, and you use in basically the multiplicative property of RSA. So you write the RSA equation as one part of m is equal to the other part of m, and you check this inequality by your baby chimp size. Algorithm. So you see the other relaxations, and well, that's for the RSA problem. An even tougher problem is recovering the RSA secret key. And this time here, so the same setting, you're given N and E, and you want to find D, such that D, well, is a secret key corresponding to E, so it's from 1 to 5N. And now you can write the RSA equation in the following form. You add 5N to this term here, and you already see if P and Q are balanced, this term here is of size roughly square root of N, so it's much smaller than N. And if you additionally relax, namely you restrict yourself to small d's, then this unknown here is small as well, and since this here is smaller than this, k must be smaller than b. So if you have a small d, all the three unknowns in this polynomial equation are small. And actually it was shown by Wiener in 1990 that as long as d is smaller than this term, you can solve this equation. Just have to reduce this modulo n, you get an equation in just two variables, d and k times this, and you can solve. And this was generalized by Pony Duffy. It's interesting, it's very simple. Once you have this equation here, you just reduce this modulo e, and then you again have a bivariate polynomial, k times something modulo e, and you get a better bound. It's a little bit surprising. So in our example, you can recover d as long as d is smaller than 292 bits. Okay, and now again, as on the first slide, we have an extension if d itself is not small, but you know parts of d. And I will give you somehow the number of bits that you have to know of d on the next slide. But as you might remember, there was a certain relaxation in the first slide. What happens if D has special properties? So if it's smooth, if it's splittable or something, I don't know whether there are some non-trivial results in this. So let's try the solving problem. Okay, so for the inhomogeneous part, here's the result. So here you have the size of D in terms of the size of n. So if n is 1,000 bit, that means D is 100 bit, 200 bit, 300 bit, and so on. And here's a fraction of the most significant bits of D that you have to know. So, as we already said, if D is smaller than 250 bits, it's Wiener's attack, so you don't have to need to know anything. That's Bonny-Duffy. And you see, if it's a little bit larger, then you just have to know a small fraction of D. And well, it's crows, it's natural. Maybe it doesn't crow in a natural way, I cannot judge. But if D is full size, you have to know everything of D. So it's somehow a reasonable result. And in fact, these are three different attacks. So that's why the graph looks a little bit strange. Okay. And well, now here's the underlying problem of RSA. So why don't we attack this problem? So that's the very simple problem. Given n, find key. Let's factor it. Okay. And the polynomial equation underlying this is also somehow trivial. If you can solve this for small values, you can factor it, because the small values are 0p, 2p, and so on. Okay, so we cannot solve this, at least brilliantly. So somehow relax this problem. Again, if you know parts of p, what happens? Well, you know some most significant bits of p, and you can show that you can solve it as long as your unknown part is at most n to the 1/4. So once over then, you have to know 250 bits of p, and then you are done. Okay. Next relaxation is somehow small p and q. So for factorization, this does not make sense because your n is a fixed size. But small means in this case that you express your n as p to the r times q for some fixed r. And well, if you have a fixed bit size here and you increase the r, the bit sizes of p and q are going down. So you expect that this problem might be a little bit easier to solve. And in fact, that's true. So you can solve it as long as the unknown part is now this bound, and you see for r equals 1, you get 1 over 2 squared, so it's exactly the bound that you got before. Okay? So, quite natural bounds, but if you would look at this guy here, p to the r, q to the s, you would think that it has an even better bound than this, right? Because somehow from information theoretical point of view, the entropy of your unknowns decreases. But it's not true. So the bound that you get here is similar to the bound that you get here, which is unnatural, shouldn't be. So it's not a problem how to do this. And it's also not a problem how to deal with factorizations when you have three prime factors. So the bound for getting the complete factorization is also worse than this one here. It's also very unintuitive. And the last problem on this slide is, what can you do if you have non-consecutive bits of p? So for now, we always assume that we had the most significant bits of p. It also works if you have the least significant bits, but if they are somehow evenly distributed over p, we don't know what happens. And that might be a fun problem to solve. So come up with non-trivial algorithms. That's also, I don't know whether lattice reduction will help you. I don't think so in this case. But now that we attacked three problems, somehow relax these problems, we want to know what happens. Oh, no, sorry. There's one more slide. So yeah, there's a factorization algorithm. So the factorization algorithm says you just guess the most significant bits of p. Well, this is done here. So you guess the most significant bits of p instead of n to the 1 over 4. Then for every guess, you run the Kupper-Schmidt algorithm. So basically what you do is you add cube, reduce, or lattice basis, which is written down here. So you have a lattice basis. A cube reduction computes you the unimodular transformation such that you get a reduced basis. And well, if your guess was correct, then you obtain the factorization, and that's it. So the complexity of this is obviously n to the 1 over 4 times the time that you can hear. So the question that we already have before is, can we extend this somehow? So do we have to guess every single step here? And well, the open problem is reduce the number of guesses. So for instance, is it possible to have two guesses at once? It's not known how to do this. And it might be a way to look at this transformation matrix. So if we go from one guess to the next one, we don't change the basis very much, right? So it might be reasonable, instead of computing this reduced basis anew for the new guess, to reuse the transformation matrix that we had before and just apply it to the new guess, because you have just an epsilon away from the old basis. So the reduced basis should look something like this. And I'm not sure whether anybody already tried this. So given the lattice basis, somehow perturb it in the entries of the lattice basis, what happens to your reduced basis? And well, there's another open problem. What happens if you have a wrong guess? Do you get some information from a wrong guess? Maybe you can guess somehow the direction in which you should go. But which, if you could exactly get the direction, you would factor in polynomial time, so it might not be true, but we don't know. There's nothing known about this. So let's try to combine all the measures that we had before. So, and especially factorization and the Bonnet-Duffy. So if you have a small d and you know bits of p. So what happens is, here's the polynomial that's underlying the Bonnet-Duffy method, and you see I reduce the RSA equation modulo e. We just have two unknowns now, k and p plus q, and we assume that in addition we know some bits of p. Right, so we write p as this here, so the unknown is now x. If we know bits of p, and these are the most significant bits, we automatically also know bits of q. So this term here, somehow gets smaller, right? The more and more bits that we guess. And you see what happens, here's the size of the unknown. So if we don't know any bits, then p and Q, the sum is of size n to the 1/2. And if we know more and more bits, the bound gets better and better on B. And that's what we expect, right? So this gets smaller, so we allow for larger D, which also means that we allow for larger K. And if you compute this function, it looks quite natural, so it's 1 minus square root of beta, and that also explains this guy here, 0.292, because it's 1 minus square root of 1/2. And well, it looks natural, so if you know everything of P and Q, then you can compute every D in this case. But if you kept attention during the talk, there should be something fishy in this graph, because we know if we have half the bits of P, then we can already factor. So that means if we are here at this point, where we know half of the bits of P, then this graph should jump up, because then we already have the information that is necessary to compute the whole factorization of n. And the open question is this the right answer? Do we have a jump from this point 1/2 to 1 at the point 1/4? It would be very unnatural. In my intuition, this graph should be maybe like this. Or maybe it should be like this. So Bonidafi might be not correct. So what was your idea? Yes, maybe like this. So I think for now the two methods do not give you the right answer. So which one is wrong? I don't know. But that's a very interesting one. For now. Might be not the correct answer. Okay, so here's another relaxation, which used to be an open problem, but now it's somehow half closed. So what happens if you don't have a small d, but you represent your d as being small modulo p minus 1 and modulo q minus 1? This is also useful for RSA because you can do the decryption process modulo p, so erase your message to the dp spore modulo p and to the dq spore mod q, and then you use Chinese remain theorem. So it was not known whether you have a polynomial time attack on this. So I did some work together with Daniel Bleichenbacher, where we also relaxed this problem to imbalanced P and Q. And as I already said, the problem should become easier if you have imbalance. And you see, well, here it was a bound. Q is something smaller than this here. This is almost balanced, and another relaxation is always small e, so we broke two RSA variants for small e as well. But for the usual RSA case where you have full size e and balanced p and q, nothing was known but a normal worst day paradox attack. And actually, if you want to try this, it's not very simple. It seems to be very simple, but you have to do the worst day paradox mod p and mod q, which you don't know. So it's an exercise for you to try this. You have to do some non-trivial things. Okay? And now, well, upcoming soon, but I don't tell you how I do it. It's a work with Alan Jochems, and we will soon publish it on the ePrint archive. We have a polynomial attack that works up to this bound. So as long as dp and dq are smaller than, well, for 1,000 bit, 703 bits, then you can factor in the polynomial time. Which is for 1,000 bit not very interesting, because you could already do it here, but for 2,000 bits it already is bound. And basically all that you have to do is run the L-cube algorithm, but in quite large level spaces. So these were the applications of the method. So now I have a more number theoretic open problem. So the problem that I want to point out is computing modular square roots modulo p. Right? We all know that there's a randomized polynomial time for this, polynomial time algorithm for this. So given a p and a quadratic residue in set B star, compute the square root of a. Right? And the task is now compute the square root x of a in deterministic polynomial time and without any unproven conjecture. So without cheating, like using extended Riemann hypotheses or something like this. So this all boils down to solving this equation here. You have a very simple equation. X squared minus a is mod p, is must have a root mod p. But if you plug it in Coppersmith's method, you get a very disappointing bound. So you get x must be smaller than p squared, which is trivial, because in this case, it just takes the square root of the integers. So that's nothing. And the question is, do we use the right method? So could we use something else? Could we use a group order, or here the sparseness of the polynomials that does not contain a linear factor, or the fact that you have special types of solutions? So, which means sparseness of this polynomial means, in fact, if you have one solution, x0, then the other is p minus x0. So nothing better is known than this bound, p to the 1/2, and it's an open problem to improve this bound somehow. Can you do this? And my intuition is that there should be out some deterministic polynomial time algorithm for computing squares of p. And it's one of the few problems that is known to be in BPP, but not known to be in p. So might be a nice challenge for you. Well, alternatively, you can think of a maybe lattice-based algorithm to solve this equation. So finding a quadratic non-residue, and as soon as you have a non-quadratic residue, you are done. If you have the Riemann hypotheses, then you know that among the first polylog numbers, you find some non-residue, but we want to find it in deterministic polynomial time without any conjecture. Well, and of course, if you have solved this problem, you can try this. So it's already a sparse polynomial. It's even more special. You have a 1 here, and you know if you solve it, then you can factor. So it might be again a tough problem. Okay. So let's say something for the methods, the Coppersmith methods. And basically, Coppersmith method divides in two parts. So either you want to find modular roots, that means you're given a polynomial, and you want to find the roots modulo some n, basically of unknown factorization, or you want to find the roots of this polynomial over the integers. And there are different formulations of Coppersmith method. So Haukrabe Krahan, 1 year after Coppersmith's initial paper, gave an alternative representation of Coppersmith's method in terms of the dual lattice. And actually, this proved to be very useful because every application ever used this formulation. So it was very nice because it's a little bit more intuitive if you read this. And the same happened in 2004, given by Jean-Sébastien Coron. He also gave an alternative in front of the dual lattice, which was very nice and solved the problem. But still, there's a small open problem left in Jean-Sébastien's algorithm. And I will come back to this problem. It has a little bit worse running time, and it does not keep the shape of the polynomial, which might be a problem. So, but before I want to state these problems, I want to give you an intuition how Coppersmith's method works for modular roots. So just keep for now two univariate polynomials. So just one variable x. We have an n of unknown factorization, and we want to find the roots of this polynomial. That is, we want to find x0 such that the value is 0 mod n. And of course, this is an upper bound on the root, and our goal is to maximize this upper bound, big x. So the idea is the following. Once we have this polynomial f, we fix some small m, and we define a collection of polynomials that all have these small roots modulo n to the n. So for instance, you could think of f1 being equal to f to the nth power. Because if it has the roots modulo n, then f to the n has the roots modulo n to the n. And think of this as being x times f to the n, something like this. So there is some flexibility here, as you already see, in defining this collection. But for now, think that we have such a collection. Now what you do is you construct an integer linear combination of these polynomials. since they all have the same root, this interlinear combination also has the same root, and we are searching for a special one, namely one such that you have the root also over the integers. And the sufficient condition for this is that at the point x0, the absolute value of this polynomial must be smaller than n to the n. So why? If it's 0 modulo m to the n, and it's an absolute value smaller than n to the n, it must be 0 over the integers. And that's it. Very simple trick. Huh? And you see what happens. Basically, from having a modular polynomial equation, you have the equation over the integers, and that's a reduction. And you also see here that it's related to lattice reduction, because you're using integer linear combinations of polynomials, and then translates in a natural way to integer linear combinations of coefficients vectors of these polynomials. So you can give a lattice space formulation of this, or, and once you have this polynomial, you just solve it over the integers. Okay, that's for the modular method in just one variable. And if you deal with more variables, it's not hard to do this, but it's heuristic. So what you do is, instead of computing just the one g, which evaluates the zero over the integers, you compute n g's, and n is the number of your variables. And afterwards, you eliminate these variables by resultant computations, and that's a heuristic, in fact, because if these gi's share a non-trivial greatest common divisor, then this resultant computations will not give you the bound. So the heuristic is, well, the heuristical part is that they don't share greatest common divisors, and it's an open problem to give some conditions under which this heuristic works. So conditions under which you you really obtain algebraically independent, well, this should be GI. And this week I learned that there's a group already working on this open problem and they have some results, so it's kind of partially solved, this open problem, for very special shapes of the polynomial. And another open problem is to find this optimal collection of polynomials. So I defined this collection, having all the zeros modulo m to the n, but it was not clear how to find this collection, and well, it turns out to be a complex combinatorial optimization problem. And here's one approach you might solve this problem. So we are given any polynomial and n variables. We want to find optimal bounds for our zeros, so we want to find optimal x1 up to xn. And in terms of lattice theory, that's equivalent to finding an optimal lattice basis for this polynomial. And the status of this problem is, it's quite easy for the univariate case, it's quite clear that you should define your collection. It's no longer trivial for the bivariate case over the integers, but, well, here is the strategy of Böhmer and myself, and we showed if you have different Newton polytopes how to do this. And well, for the multivariate case, it's basically unclear. So there's a joint work with Jochems. We give some strategies how to do it, but it's not clear that they achieve the optimal polynomials. They just give you some bounds, but it's not clear whether these are the optimal bounds that you can obtain. And well, it's work in progress with Damian Steele. And well, the goal is to solve this problem here. So you're given any polynomial, and the algorithm basically outputs you a collection which gives you an optimal bound. And I would call it a Krippner basis-like approach, because what we do is, given this polynomial, we add up every polynomial up unto a certain degree. So we fix some degree d, we add to our basis every polynomial, or every coefficient vector of a polynomial, up to a certain degree b, and that then, instead of doing Gaussian elimination, we just choose a proper sublattice using the acute reduction. So basically, it's Krippner basis with some Gaussian elimination replaced by a cube reduction. And we'll see whether this works or not. So, okay. So for now, I told you how the modular method works. Here's the integer method. And I don't want to formally give you the details of this method. Instead, I want to give you an example. And this example is factoring given bits known. So you are given bits of P, you're given bits of Q. You want to find the roots of these polynomials, which we want to find the factorization of N in this case. We have this polynomial here. And now you build up your Lattice spaces, your Cauchy sub Lattice spaces in the following form. And here, the Lattice spaces vectors are rows of this matrix. Right? So here you see the coefficients of the polynomial. That's the coefficient of x, y, that's the coefficient of y, and so on. And you should now observe that this Lattice spaces contains a vector, which I call target vector, which is the following linear combination of rows. Namely, you multiply the first row by x0, y0, the second by y0, and so on. So what happens in this case? So for the first three entries, it's clear you just multiply. These are upper bounds for x0 and y0. So what you get is some fraction here, x0, y0, over this. And then this here is an upper bound. You know that this entry here is smaller than 1. So it corresponds to a small vector in the lattice. And what you see in the last column is if you have the right root, then this basically means that you evaluate the polynomial at this point. But if you evaluate the polynomial at this point, it's a zero. So you know already if you have the right target vector that the last entry is zero. And basically, you are searching for vectors which have the last entry zero. And since you already know this, you can go over to a sublattice. Namely, you just consider all the vectors of this lattice spaces which has as the last entry zero. So what you can do is, without any lattice reduction, you can transform this four-dimensional lattice spaces into a three-dimensional lattice spaces. Namely, you do just elimination here on this column such that you get zeros here and a one here. So basically, you also do not change the determinant of your lattice spaces. This is the determinant of this is still the same as the determinant of this here. And instead of reducing this very basis here, you reduce just the three-dimensional lattice spaces. Right. So what do you do in coherence method? In coherence method, you have the same polynomial f, but now you have to transform it into a different polynomial, namely such that the constant term of your polynomial gets a 1. So what you choose is you choose an R of suitable size, and you reduce your polynomial modulo R, and you compute the inverse of your constant and multiply such that you get a 1 here in this entry. And the lattice spaces that you have now is just the coefficient vector here, and you fill up your matrix with Rx, Ry, and Rxy. It's not hard to show that if you find in this lattice spaces a vector which is sufficiently small norm, then out of this vector you get a coefficient vector of Gxy, which evaluates to 0 over the integers at your desired root. But the open question in this method is, can you also have such a dimension reduction trick as in the method before? Because in the method before, it was clear you were searching for some entry which was 0 in the last component, so it was clear how to do it without lattice reduction, but here it's no longer clear. And actually, it's not a matter of just a dimension reduction from 4 to 3, but if you evaluate these algorithms, that it turns out that you have an error term in these algorithms, and well, the behavior of Coherence method is exponentially bad in this Sarah McDonald. Whereas in coppersmiths, it's pretty dominant in that. So it's really, really a problem in this method. It's a nice method, but it's not clear how to do it. And I also told you there's another problem in this method, which was, I think, not mentioned yet. So as you already have seen, you have to have a constant term which is 1, because otherwise this method does not work. So let's assume you have a polynomial which does not contain a constant term. So you cannot apply this trick that you had before. So look at this term, polynomial, it has a 0 constant term. So Coron's suggestion was the following. Well, if you have such a polynomial, then simply transfer it to another polynomial which has a non-zero constant term. So it's always simple. But what happens is that you change the set of monomials of the polynomial. So instead of having these monomials here, x squared y, x squared, and y squared, you get additional monomials. And well, that also changes the Newton polytope of your polynomial. The Newton polytope is just the exponents of this monomial viewed in the Euclidean space. So the Newton polytope consists of the points 2, 1, 1, 1, 0, 1, 2, 0, and so on, and then you take the convex half. And if you look at the analysis of Coppersmith's method, it clearly depends on the Newton polytopes that you have. So if you change the shape of your Newton polytope, you get an immediately different analysis. So the collection that you get is not the same anymore. It's not clear how you can fix this problem here, because this transformation will normally not work. And moreover, if you change your Newton polytope and you get more points, the analysis gets worse. So you get worse bounds with this method. It's not clear how to fix this. So that would be also a very nice problem if you could solve this. Okay, so these were the problems with the method. And now everything, well, I always use it for cryptanalysis, so we were quite destructively. So the question is, can you also use these bounds constructively? And yes, there's an answer, which was given this year. And the idea is the following. So assume that for a certain fixed polynomial with a certain Newton polytope, you have an optimal bound. So for instance, think of x and y are smaller than n squared. Now you make a hardness assumption. You assume that it's not possible to compute the roots of this polynomial within the bound x, y is larger than n to the 1/2 plus delta for some suitable delta. So you know it's polynomial time up to this bound, but you assume that it's exponential time if you go far away from the bound. And well, the idea is simple. Now you should construct primitives based on this Hartmann's assumption, and this was done by Steinfeld, Pritchik, and Wang this year, and will be presented at AsiaCrypt, where they show that you can construct an RSA pseudo-random number generator which outputs per iteration a constant fraction of all the bits. And currently, up to this result, the best known bound was a constant fraction in the log of n. And this result was by Fischlin and Schnorr. And now they showed, and this result actually this year by Fischlin and Schnorr was based on the hardness of the RSA problem. But you see, if you replace this hardness assumption by some maybe weaker assumption, that you can gain a lot. And this was done here. And the question is, can you extend this to other problems? It seems reasonable that if you use some weaker assumptions, you get more. And in this case, you get much more in terms of the bits. Okay, so let's come to the last application of lattice reduction. So, and it's a little bit related what Daniele said. So dealing with cyclic lattices and Andrew, well, Andrew is not in fact a cyclic lattices, but it has some structure which corresponds to cyclic lattices. So here are the entry parameters. So you have secret keys in F and in G, which are polynomials in this ring, so the coefficients are mod Q, and you're working mod x to the n minus 1, which means that x to the n is 1, and that in turn means that multiplying polynomials in this ring is very efficient, because you have very efficient reductions here. F and G have small norm, and you really need this in N-proof in order to decrypt. And the public key is just a polynomial that satisfies this equation. So F times H is G. Well, in the usual sense, you identify polynomials now with the coefficient vectors. And it's quite easy to see if you multiply one polynomial by x, then this is a rotation of the coefficient vector, because x is mapped to x squared and so on, but this here is mapped to x to the n, so it's mapped to the first x to 0. And it was already observed by Coppersmith and Shamir that in order to break N-true, you have to find its heuristic. But I think the heuristic is correct, because there are no shorter vectors in this lattice. You have to find the shortest vector, which is this lattice, which is also called convolution modular lattice spaces. So let's see how it works. So again, the lattice spaces vectors are the rows of this matrix. So if you multiply the first n rows by f0 up to fn minus 1, then you obtain f0 times this plus f1 times this, and so on. And so you see the coefficient that you get here is g0 up to the mod q reduction, and the mod q reduction is done by this part here. And you also see that if you multiply the polynomial f by x, then this, you also multiply the polynomial g by x. So which means that you can rotate this target vector. And well, it's a very simple observation. So you see, you have this target vector in the lattice. You know that f and g have small norm, so it's a small norm vector in the lattice. And the lattice contains all the rotations of this target vector as well. So now a heuristic, but I don't know how good the heuristic is. So what you do is you reduce your lattice spaces B, you find the shortest vector of the lattice spaces, and afterwards you include all the rotations of B to the I in your basis and you iterate. Well, this does not give you a basis again, but a generating system, but that's not a problem for lattice reduction. So, and after one iteration, you would assume that the nth successive minimum of your lattice is about the first successive minimum of the last round. So the vectors in your basis should drop somehow faster than usual. I don't know whether anybody has ever tried this. I didn't. The only problem is how good is this. I have no idea. So the problem might be that after one cube reduction or BKSET reduction or whatever reduction you use, the vectors in your basis are all of the same length. In this case, this heuristic doesn't give you anything, because if they are all of the same length, the length does not drop very fast. But, well, I don't expect this. At least it should help somehow. Not from a complexity theoretic point of view, maybe, but, well, attacking instances is also attacking special instances. So if you could somehow increase the bounds for attacking it, that would be interesting as well. Okay? And the open problem that Daniela already mentioned is speed up your lattice reduction method. So really use the fact that you are using cyclic lattices in your lattice basis reduction, because this was not attacked at all. So it was not the purpose of lattice reduction. And if you know that your instance is a cyclic lattice, you might get up with better algorithms. So that leaves me the summary of the main problems. So first main open problem was the complexity of factoring with known bits. It was not known how to extend this factoring method such that you can combine some of the gases, come up with a combination. Then we had a strange thing going on with no results for RSA attacks. We had two attacks that did not match somehow in crab. We had a time-mature chump, and it's not known how to avoid this chump. Well, for the methods, it was open how to find an optimum collection of the bounds, and it would be nice to have some automatic bound computation for ladder spaces. And as you already have seen, for the integer case, it would be nice to have a formulation in terms of the dual ladders. We already have a very nice formulation of Coron, but you have to fix two more problems in Coron's method. And well, this was related to something like a small roots assumption. So if you relax usual cryptographic assumptions like the RSA assumption with some assumption that tells you it's hard to construct in polynomial time roots of this polynomial, then can you construct better primitives for this? And well, the last is maybe also for fun, tech cycling lattices. Might turn out that this is a good